This is a continuation from parts 1 and 2. This is part 3, chapter 15 to 20 of the book titled The Path to Nibbana. How mindfulness of loving kindness progresses through the tranquil aware jhanas to awakening. By David C. Johnson. Copyright 2018 David C. Johnson. 3rd edition 4-16 2018. Published by BTS Publishing. Annapolis, Missouri. Chapter 15. First Stage of Awakening, Sotapanna. MN 111 Section 19. Again, monks, by completely surmounting the base of neither perception nor non-perception, Sariputta, entered upon and abided in the cessation of perception and feeling, attaining Nibbana, path knowledge, Magga. Finally, after staying with this quiet, energetic, imperturbable mind of the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and six-ring every tiny movement until mind is barely moving at all, you let go of the last condition, the last link of ignorance, and all activity ceases. Everything stops and an unconditioned state arises. There is the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, for a few moments or minutes. You don't know you're in that state until after you come out. Some will say they experienced a blank spot or a gap in consciousness. This is nothing like any of you previous jhana experiences. It isn't a gap with a sense of time because there is nothing missing. Time doesn't exist when nothing is happening. There is just the stopping of the stream of consciousness, a halting. You only know it after you come out of it. The world stops, you are no longer in samsara, and it will last as long as it's going to last. Does life still exist? Vitality and your life continuum still go on. Your autonomic functions, like your heart beating and blood pumping, continue, but your mental process has stopped completely. When I finished radiating equanimity to each of the points, something extremely new happened, a feeling I had felt in a meditation a couple of days ago, but it was now much clearer and more defined. In a second, it was as if a membrane around me totally broke and released me. 1 second, for there a huge space opened up before me, the feeling that there was so much room, there were no barriers. At the same moment, my face begins to fade, as if something was literally erasing it, and left me without skin or muscles. There was happiness, but without excitement, tranquility, and a very, very refined attention. Barcelona, Spain. Before, there just existed slight movements of mind. But now, with this temporary cessation of all mental activity, there arises right after that a powerful clarity of mind. You have just had the deepest rest of your life. When you come back, you are now seeing the subtlest movements, deeper than you have ever experienced. Mind appears like a totally erased blackboard. Nothing is on it. Then, when mind turns back on, the first mental process is clearly seen against this inky black background. Coming out of cessation, mind is radiant and observant. You have arrived at full stop. The effect of the cessation is so powerful that whereas before the pond of your mind had tiny little ripples on it, now it is so still and placid that you can see anything there. You can see to any depth what is below. There is no craving at all. There is no dust to obscure vision. Mind is so pure that you see the smallest detail of anything that starts to arise in crystal clarity. What you are about to see is the first arising of consciousness, the first moment of mental activity. As your mental processes begin again from this still point, the next thing that happens is that you see the links of dependent origination arise and pass away very quickly. These are sometimes in the form of vibrations, a little lights, flashes, or electrical currents. You will see this in your mind and sometimes even see it in the air in front of you. You won't know what it is, very likely, and will not expect it. This is the first conditioned mental process in which your mind starts to vibrate again and come back online. When this happens, the eye of wisdom, mind without craving, sees the total impersonality of the process. There is no self there. Your deep observation understands that there is nobody home, that what you are is just a process of moments arising and passing away. As a result of this profound insight, the supramundane unconditioned Nibbana arises. This experience will be followed by a momentary sense of relief, like a burden was lifted off. You have just experienced Nibbana. You have become a Sotapanna. In meditation, things began to slow down. The vibration slowed to a ripple that ended in bright light. I went deeper and things seemed slower. There seemed to be something breaking up in the light. I went even deeper until the distractions abruptly stopped, like the plug had been pulled out. Mind activity abruptly stopped. What was left was like a blackout. The center seemed darker than the edges. For a moment it felt like something was missing. I didn't feel joy, more like a calm relief. CB, Sri Lanka. Nibbana will not come when you want it. It will come when you are ready, when the seven factors of awakening all line up in perfect balance, like passing through the keyhole of the door. You didn't think it could be possible, yet it happened. You see that, in this seemingly permanent and eternal psychophysical process, when mind stops, there really is nothing between each thought moment that persists. That knowledge leads you to understand that an impersonal underlies everything. There is nothing that is continuous between each moment, nothing that survives. Not even God, nothing. Everything is absolutely void of self or soul. MN 111 section 19 Kant. And his taints were destroyed by his seeing with wisdom. The word here is wisdom. So, what is wisdom? After the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, and it's going to last as long as it will last, when feeling, perception, and consciousness start up again, you have the opportunity of seeing exactly, clearly, with very sharp mindfulness, every one of the links of dependent origination. You will see how, when this doesn't arise, that doesn't arise, that each link is dependent on the previous link. You will see that everything has a cause for arising. You have uncovered the last link of ignorance. You will also see that if it arises, it will come to an end. You will see impermanence clearly. All that arises will pass away, whether it be pleasure or pain. This is wisdom. It is the knowledge that you gain by directly seeing the links of dependent origination arise and pass away, and by seeing that there is no enduring self. This wisdom is not some sort of conceptual philosophy, some religious tenet or dogma. It is the result of seeing directly. When you see the word wisdom in the suttas, you should understand that this always means seeing the links of dependent origination directly and seeing everything that arises as impersonal. It isn't learning a philosophy, it is directly observing reality. With the next mental process that arises, you'll see the whole arising and passing away of all of the links of dependent origination for the duration of one instant. Then there is the final letting go of ignorance and seeing the Four Noble Truths. That is when Nibbana occurs. It is just a momentary event and just one group of links firing. The links are seen with wisdom's eye. This takes place at a deeper level than normal awareness. People will say they don't know what they saw, but they will know. The mind, to a greater or lesser degree, will be having insights arise into how there is a cause that creates a result. This constant arising and passing away of conditioned existence is the content of who we are, and that's all there is. They will now understand at an intuitive level how dependent origination works. Each link is conditioned by the previous link. Each process is conditioned by the passing away of another process, like a candle flame that lights another candle. One candle burns down, but the next candle lights up, being ignited by the previous candle. Bit by bit you arise and pass away. You are changing little by little over time. Like a great city that arises from an empty piece of land, each building arises one at a time. Each shovel of dirt carried off and dumped one at a time. With the constant arising and passing away of causes, this great city is built. The next shovel full of dirt taken away changes it. Once again, no one person has built it, just many shovels and people shoveling. It's a process with no real beginning and no real end. We give cities names, but these are just concepts to label these groups of buildings. The perception aggregate of the five aggregates is partially memory and part labeling. Perception is what puts a name on this group of buildings. It labels it either New York or San Francisco, depending on what, for example, visual forms arise. In our own case, we're given a name, like John, and then we personally identify with that name as if some underlying entity were controlling everything. But it isn't. It is just a concept. The city itself is not one solid thing. It is the result of all these causes that make it what it is, but in this instant only, in the next moment, it has changed to something else. In the same way, you are a completely impersonal process. There is no one or soul behind it. It is automatically happening and will continue forever into the future until you become fully awake and exit the wheel of samsara. This is so profound that after these links pass away, nibbana arises just for an instant. In the suttas it says, "Dot and his taints were destroyed with wisdom," meaning that nibbana arises right after you see the links of dependent origination, and it destroys a certain measured amount of craving. It destroys the first three, what are called fetters. Step-by-step attainment of nibbana. The cessation of feeling, perception, and consciousness occurs. This means that everything we consider a person stops. There is a blank state, a blackout of voidness. All mental activity stops. On an EEG one would guess the indicator flatlines for just a moment. Following the cessation, because of the incredible clarity created by the experience of cessation, the first mental activity, a set of 12 links, arises and passes away. They might be seen like bubbles, a little flashing lights. Wisdom's eye observes utter and total impersonality in this first mental process as the links arise and pass away. With no craving to cloud mind, the links are seen as just an impersonal process with no inherent self. Just a group of neurons firing. That is all you are. After the last link of ignorance passes away, nibbana arises. There is a feeling of relief for a moment, a unique feeling in the mind that there has been a great burden thrown off. Joy starts to arise, all-pervading joy that can last for up to several days. It may continue longer, but sometimes you just get used to the state and don't notice it anymore. Note that the relief and the joy that follows are different feelings. You should notice this difference. There was definitely joy, but I think what followed was the mind jumping for a brief moment, oh wow, what just happened? Because it was not like the nothingness between the flickering of consciousness, and yet pervading joy persisted after the blanking out and continued even after the meditation. This kind of joy I couldn't compare to drunkenness, although I can see how people might do so, because if I caught myself in the mirror, my eyes were just so relaxed and I had a wide smile on my face. It's definitely of a different quality. I think Bhante once called it relief, and I could definitely apply that to it. Mind was totally equanimous and relaxed and balanced and only focused on what the body was doing, no matter how mundane. 4. Example, when I went to put pizza in the oven, there were no reflections or thoughts or anything in the mind. My focus was on unboxing the pizza, slowly, almost like an automaton, without any involvement, yet I was totally present and aware of each action happening. SD, California. The first time nibbana occurs, many people will not recognize or see the 12 links, but they will have the experience of nibbana regardless. At the next level called fruition, it is likely they will witness more clearly the links arising and passing away. Fruition knowledge is much deeper. It happens in this way for many people when they experience the first path. The Sotapanna path knowledge can have the cessation with the relief, but the links themselves just are not clear. They may report more often a blackout where they just disappeared and then came back. The fruition will be attained late after they have practiced some more. This will cement in the attainment in a deeper way. Again, when wisdom arises, the first three of the 10 fetters are eliminated in the first path attainment. All of the fetters are fully abandoned after the attainment of full awakening, which is arahantship. What is nibbana? Nibbana is described in the Pali texts as a dhatu or element, earth, air, fire, water, space, and consciousness are elements as taught by the Buddha. The Nibbana Dhatu is also an element, and its other qualities are described by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Here, the Buddha also refers to Nibbana as a ayatana. This means realm, plane, or sphere. It is a sphere where there is nothing at all that corresponds to our mundane experience, and therefore it has to be described by way of negations as the negation of all the limited and determinate qualities of conditioned things. The Buddha also refers to Nibbana as a dhatu, an element, the deathless element. He compares the element of Nibbana to an ocean. He says that just as the great ocean remains at the same level no matter how much water pours into it from the rivers, without increase or decrease, so the Nibbana element remains the same, no matter whether many or few people attain Nibbana. He also speaks of Nibbana as something that can be experienced by the body, an experience that is so vivid, so powerful, that it can be described as touching the deathless element with one's own body. The Buddha also refers to Nibbana as a state, pada, as amitapada, the deathless state, or akute pada, the imperishable state. Another word used by the Buddha to refer to Nibbana is sakka, which means truth, an existing reality. This refers to Nibbana as the truth, a reality that the noble ones have known through direct experience. So, all these terms, considered as a whole, clearly establish that Nibbana is an actual reality and not the mere destruction of defilements or the cessation of existence. Nibbana is unconditioned, without any origination, and is timeless. When the Nibbana element touches craving, it is like the water of the great ocean putting the fire out. PSSS is no more fire. Ni means no, and bana means fire, no fire. Nibbana. Venerable Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, in an article entitled Nibbana for Everyone, a truth message from Suan Mok, adapted and translated by Santikaro Bhikkhu, also defines Nibbana as an element. It is the coolness when the defilements are ended. Nibbana was a whole other matter than death. Instead, it's a kind of life that knows no death. Nibbana is the thing which sustains life, thus preventing death. It itself can never die, although the body must die. Eventual lie. The cessation and the experience of Nibbana are two different things. Some say when mind stops that is Nibbana. No, it is what happens afterward which is seeing the links arise that causes the profound insight into existence to arise. That is Nibbana. We can't describe the experiences of Nibbana that happens in each path of sainthood with conditioned words, as it is beyond our conceptual mind to perceive. But it is what comes after the experience that gives you a clue as to what has just happened. As described before, some explain feeling a moment of relief after it happens. Some experience a deep understanding of dependent origination. Some say they just went away into a black hole, or disappeared. Then, slowly, a mild to strong euphoria arises. I am careful not to use the word joy here, it is beyond that. Some describe it like steam that ascends slowly in mind, or perhaps a minty feeling. This is what we call all-pervading joy. It seeps out from every pore of your body. You may not notice it at first, but soon you feel very uplifted and elevated. It is a feeling of happiness, but grounded in very strong equanimity. You realize, in a flash, that there is no controller. There is no ego. There is no self. Everything is impersonal. It is said, no self, no problem. What a relief. There is nothing to worry about or control. It is all impersonal, arising and passing away on its own. All of these mental states are arising from causes. They are just conditioned by previous actions. In fact, the meaning of kamma, Pali, or karma, Sanskrit, is action. There is the action and then the result from that action, vipaka. There is no self that you need to psychoanalyze to get to the real problem of this depression and neurosis. Once the concept of self is gone, there is nobody left to be depressed, or more clearly, nobody left to take a painful feeling personally. It is only a feeling and it isn't your feeling. You may notice that everything looks a little different now. Your senses appear to be heightened more than normal. Meditation might make them. Colors are brighter, or you just find yourself looking at the trees with awe and wonder. You notice the mind is sublimely quiet. You'll be asked if you notice a change in your personality. Do you feel different? Do you have a change in perspective? For some, it is a dramatic change, and for others, it is subtler. In terms of perception, yes, I can see a noticeable shift. Everything that's happening around me no longer has my emotional involvement, good, bad, or indifferent. There's a visible and experiential impersonal nature to the events around me, and my mind is no longer reacting to things. I'm taking my time with things, not in a rush. There's nowhere to go, what's the hurry, and there's a pleasantness pervading my CTNs, calm, collected and happy, SD. California. You will say your mind feels very relieved and happy. You talk about how you understand now how everything arises due to causes and conditions. You are starting to understand deeply what the links are and how they're dependent on each other. Instead of understanding them intellectually, you now understand them directly. You may use the simile of the cloth as the Buddha did, how everything, with its causes and conditions, weaves together to make a cloth. It is all impersonal. Sutta means thread in Pali. All the suttas weave together to make the cloth. The cloth represents your wise understanding of the whole process of the Buddha's teaching. Prior to it, the experience, I felt gradual changes after each sitting, like anger reducing and catching some thoughts half way. After the blackout, anger, worries, stress, etc. seemed to be massively reduced, peace of mind. Occasionally negative things would arise and I could feel a slight tension that I would relax, but didn't require too much manual intervention. Also, unlike earlier where I was catching them halfway through, I was aware of them much earlier. My senses seem more acute, smells are stronger, colors seem brighter, and I'm seeing details I didn't before. See Sri Lanka. You may or may not remember seeing very much of this, but you will know it. This is wisdom's eye. The profound knowledge. From directly seeing, the deep mind sees what happened, and it has understood what it means. This is wisdom, seeing the links of dependent origination. This is the path knowledge. You are now on the path to the full experience of the first stage of awakening. Decisions arise in your mind, and you commit an action that has a result, like a painful or pleasant feeling arising in the future. Breaking precepts results in painful consequences. Following precepts result in wholesome, pleasant results. What results do you want? Now you know what is wholesome and what leads to wholesome. Most people will experience the first path knowledge in a sitting meditation, but some have reported that it happened after washing dishes or even turning over and going back to sleep. Nibbana happens when your knowledge is mature and you are ready. At the meditation center in Missouri, we see people get the path attainment every now and then, and one of the principal ways you can tell is that the face changes. It is like all the tension from a lifetime just disappears. It looks as though the face drops, the wrinkled forehead flattens out. You can just see the equanimity bubbling. There is a glowing and a radiance that is there. The speech is more controlled and less emotional. Many times Bhante, after he comes from the interviews, will point out a meditator to me and say, "Look at the face." When I look, if I look close enough, I see an emotionless but peaceful angelic expression, just a big smile with a glowing radiance that wasn't there before. After a few days, the most dramatic of these effects disappears as the hindrances make the way back just not as strong as before. Started off radiating equanimity, which was strong right after walking with radiating equanimity. Immediately went into neither perception nor non-perception. No desire, no craving for anything, just allowing mind to relax deeper and deeper and deeper while staying on quiet mind. A cessation blank occurred, and immediately after emergence stayed in 8th jhana for a while, then came out and continued to 6R. The joy and equanimity that followed was refreshing. The view of the world around has changed drastically. There is non-attachment and non-aversion, as I'm just staying with quiet mind, smiling without effort and radiating compassion to others. I've noticed I'm unable to break the precepts, in that I'm automatically following them without a second thought and without effort. Sense of me has just vanished. The world is seriously different in the way it is experienced since I began this retreat. Sensual pleasures are nothing compared to the meditation, and being unhappy seems like an impossibility. There is tremendous silence in the mind, and interactions with others are joyful and happy, with lots of laughing and delightful words all the while radiating loving kindness to them. Attachment or aversion make no sense at all when there's no one being attached or feeling aversion, and no thoughts in the mind. Sense of ownership too has faded. There's nothing to own or keep. What comes, comes, and what goes, goes. If it comes, okay. If it goes, okay. 2. I'm in automatic happiness mode. Everything that happens around me can be good or bad or nothing at all, and I can just smile, laugh, and be happy for no reason. There's no sense of tiredness or lethargy. Who is being tired? Moreover, calming out of the meditation seems to generate a lot of energy for the day. It's better than any energy drink or coffee. Craving has become minuscule. It just doesn't register as something the mind can do anymore. SD California. Sotapanna fruition phala. The first path knowledge, which is experienced one time, is followed by the first fruition knowledge. The path knowledge gets you through the door. The fruition knowledge closes the door and locks in your understanding. This all happens when you have another cessation moment arise in your meditation, and you experience nibbana. Again, after you experience the Sotapanna path attainment as outlined above, then if you sit and continue to meditate exactly as you did before, you will experience that process of a blank spot and flashes again, with another feeling of relief. This is the Sotapanna fruition. This is the first stage of 4 stages of sainthood. You have entered the temple now, but there are 3 more levels of attainment following Sotapanna, which we will get into following this chapter. However, you might be too restless to sit right after your path attainment. This is due to the strong all-pervading joy you will be experiencing over the next few days. As your energy wanes, you'll be encouraged to go back to your chair or cushion and gain the fruition of Sotapanna. You may be told that your mind is very strong now. Do not waste any time. Use this time to make even more progress. You are understandably happy about your path experience, but now that your mind is bright and very clear, it is helpful to continue to the fruit of the first stage of awakening. Your mind is open and ready, so just continue with your practice. Gaining the fruit is what changes the personality in a major way. Gaining the first path is a preliminary step to gaining the full attainment and fruition of Sotapanna. The meditator with only the path experience can actually slide back due to bad behavior in breaking precepts. You can lose your attainment. This is why it is called the path knowledge. You have become a Kala Sotapanna, little stream enterer. You are still on the path, not done yet. You must keep the precepts fully, meditate, and attain cessation once again. Once the fruition is attained, the path has been fully traveled, and you are now a noble one who will never break the precepts. You have reached the first level of sainthood. Bhante Vimalaram, she likes to say, you have given up an ocean of suffering. A Sotapanna purifies and eliminates from his mind the first 3 fetters of being. There are 10 in all. 1. Sakkaya Ditti, personality belief. You now know, without any doubt, that there is no permanent self or soul. 2. Visakhicca, skeptical doubt about the Dharma. You will have no doubt about the path. You will know how you achieved what you did and how to continue the practice. You have total confidence in the Buddha's method. You have full confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. 3. Sīlabhāta paramasa, clinging to rites and rituals, thinking that they will, by themselves, lead to awakening. You will understand that bowing, chanting, or worshipping the Buddha will not get you to the experience of Nibbāna, no matter how much you do this. You must do the work of meditation and study to attain Nibbāna. With the second step of fruition being attained, you'll not be able to break precepts anymore. You might try to do it just as a test, but you won't be able to go through with it. With only the path knowledge, you could potentially break them. And this is the danger of not attaining the fruit. With only the first path knowledge, it is still possible that if you did continue to break precepts and behave badly, you could lose your attainment. You would have to go through the process, having the experience of seeing dependent origination again. Sutta MN 105 Sunakata Sutta addresses this possibility with the simile of the wound and healing. If one does not take care of the wound, it is liable to become infected. However, with proper care, the wound will heal completely without any possibility of becoming infected. In the same way, with the proper taking care of path knowledge, your attainment will not be lost. With the fruition, your attainment is locked in. There is no going back to the state of the worldling Padujjana. As a Sotapanna, you're destined to have no more than 7 lifetimes before you get off the wheel, become a full arahant, with all 10 fetters destroyed, and attain final parinibbana. Also, when you are reborn, at worst you will not fall below the human realm. You are also assured that your next life will be pleasant, where you can continue to do your work to get off the wheel. There are 31 planes of existences. You will not fall into the painful, hellish realms now. You won't come back as an animal, a ghost. You may return to the human realm, or to one of the 6 deva or celestial heaven realms, where there is only enjoyment and pleasures. If you attained jhana, and you certainly did practicing TWIM, you would be destined for at least one of the Brahma realms with incredibly long lifespans, where beings feed on joy to sustain themselves. Or you may go even higher into one of the 4 Arupa realms, where there is only mind, no tasting or touching. They're exclusively mental realms with no physical body. In these realms, it is said that lifespans are measured with a 1 followed by miles of zeros, so they are very long. If for some reason you have only attained the path knowledge and haven't broken precepts, but you did not continue your meditation in this lifetime, the suttas say you will attain the fruition on or before your death. Most of the time it will come a lot sooner. On a retreat, fruition could come in only a few days or even hours if you continue to practice without a break. Recently, a man in Chicago experienced the path at lunchtime, and the fruition arose for him at 1:20 a.m. that night. He didn't see the links the first time, but with the fruition he did report them. All the higher paths are attained by just continuing the practice in the same way. There will be deeper and subtler fetters to see and abandon. Your meditation will be easier, but still, the balance of the fetters will continue to arise. Now your confidence will be very strong, and you'll be without doubt. The suttas also describe another way of becoming a Sotapanna. Simply hearing a passage of text can bring about the Sotapanna or Sakadagami paths. In one translation, Sota means ear, and Panna means wisdom, wisdom through hearing. This is rare, but it did happen for many of the Buddha's disciples, like Sariputta and Moggallana. But for this to happen, the teacher must say exactly the right thing, and the student must be ready. Again, this is a very rare occurrence, and it tends to take a Buddha to accomplish it. Now you have had the first 2 experiences of Nibbana and have become a Sotapanna with fruition. This is the goal of the 8 jhanas and the path I have been describing. You have become a noble one, one who has now broken out of the samsaric wheel of existences, but there is still more to do. There are the 4 levels of noble ones and 3 more I will describe below that you still must go through to fully eliminate all craving in your mind if you want to accomplish all of this in one lifetime. Chapter 16, Second Stage. Sakadagami. Meditation Instruction. Now that you have attained the first path and fruition of Sotapanna, how do you continue? That is easy, just keep doing what you are doing. Each stage of awakening is just one more step on the ladder to eliminating craving. Now the meditator spends 2 minutes in each direction, radiating equanimity, and then all around as before. And again, when the feeling fades away, you observe the quiet, clear mind and 6 are any phenomena that arise. That's it, just keep going. And this is the process all the way to the highest attainment. The second stage of awakening is a continued deepening of the meditation practice. You become a Sakadagami when you see the links of dependent origination arising and passing away twice versus only one time for the Sotapanna. There is a cessation. And you quickly see the 12 links of dependent origination one time, and then they arise and pass away a second time. Right after the first, in total 24 links arise and pass away all at once, like train cars, one after the other. This seeing of the links is followed by a moment of relief. This is not just based on the sutta texts but has been observed in students' experience. After you attain Sakadagami Path Magga, the Sakadagami fruition phala comes when you once again experience cessation and the links of dependent origination arising and passing away twice. Sometimes in the path experience the student does not actually see the bubbles, which are the links, but they will see them at the fruition. As before, it is at fruition where the personality changes permanently. Path knowledge means really you are just on the path to the fruit completion of the Sakadagami stage. At this stage, you weaken but don't fully eliminate the fetters of 1. Kama raga, sensuous craving or lust. 2. Vyapada, ill will, hatred, anger, aversion, and fear. These have been loosened. At times, these unwholesome states will still arise if the circumstance presents itself. You will tend to avoid anger and lust, seeing them as coarse states. If they arise, you will notice 6 are them, you'll be surprised. If they hang around very long, you'll be motivated to continue your meditation to fully eliminate these disturbing states of mind, but they will still be present, just not as strong. It is at the fruition there is a strong release and letting go of sensual desires. This doesn't necessarily mean sexual desire, but the coarse desires for sensual pleasures like entertainment, eating out, and bodily pleasure. Sexual desire is deeper and is let go later. A note here is that if the fruition of any path is not experienced in this lifetime, it will happen upon your death. As a Sakadagami, you will have no more than just one time that you have to return to the human or higher realms before you attain final parinibbana and release from samsara. As a Sotapanna, it was 7. The quality of the sitting was much different from the first session today, this one being the final meditation of today. I began with quiet mind as object after having done the walking meditation with equanimity as the object. No preconceptions if what was to come in the meditation. Automatic 6 ring, which has become an impersonal and automatic process. A blank occurred, and there was strong balance, but more so quality of mind itself is transformed. It's as if, and the best way I can describe it is to use a metaphor, like the mind of an infant wouldn't know exactly how an infant's mind works, and what I mean by that is mind is empty, empty of concepts, empty of thoughts, empty of identity, empty of sorrow, empty even of bliss. Certainly bliss arose after the blank, but the mind is, following this meditation, totally free. There is no craving, there is no wanting, desire striving to be or not be. Mind functions according to the needs of a given moment, but otherwise is utterly and profoundly quiet. Even the concept of being in the moment is utterly gone. Who is there to be in the moment? Total freedom from all ideas, notions, beliefs, thoughts. A fresh and clean slate, SD. California. 3 ways to Nibbana. As outlined in this book, the first and easiest way to reach Nibbana is through the jhana path, what I'm describing in this book. There are, however, 2 other ways to attain Nibbana. The second way is the way the Buddha's own awakening process unfolded. He went to the 4th jhana and then, 1. He remembered his past lives, 2. He visited other realms and saw how and why beings were reborn there, and finally, 3. He saw how karma works, how causes create in more causes, in a never-ending wheel that leads to old age and death. Disenchantment and dispassion arose through this knowledge, and Nibbana was attained. This way is called the threefold knowledge, or Tavijja, that is, 1. Knowledge of past lives, 2. Knowledge of beings in other realms, and 3. Knowledge of the destruction of the taints, Nibbana. The third way is through attaining all the psychic powers or iddhis and then attaining Nibbana. This practice is most suited to people who are sensitive to feeling or emotionally driven. Being sensitive to feeling means you are a feeling type person who is governed by your heart. The other type of person is an intellectual person ruled by logic and pragmatic decisions. They are best suited to go through the jhanas. People who are mixed may take the Buddha's path of the threefold knowledge or go through the jhanas. You can be taught to remember your past lives, but we will not go into this practice here. You can ask the teacher if it would be helpful, and they can decide whether they will teach it to you based on your progress and your personality type. The psychic power route is a difficult path and can take many years. It brings with it the danger of becoming attached to these powers and not wanting to proceed. It can bring up a lot of conceit and arrogance about having such unique abilities. In the opinion of the Bhante Vimalaramshi, it is the most difficult of the ways. He says you can learn this, but it will take you 10 years, and you will have to stay with him for that whole time. Chapter 17, Third Stage, Anagami. The Buddha considered the first and second stage of attainments to be learner states. The fruit of the meditation starts to develop at the next stage of anagami, where hatred and sensual desire are eliminated together with the previous three taints that were eliminated at Sotapanna. These are the five lower fetters. This is truly a worthy and elevated state of being. Arahant, which is the fourth and final stage, then eliminates the rest of the 10 fetters completely. To attain the higher paths of anagami and arahant, one must practice meditation. Whereas before one might have become awakened to the first two paths just by listening to a phrase, it will now require intense meditation practice with full passage through the jhanas. Deep meditation is needed to see even more clearly the nature of the links of dependent origination and how mind is working, taking everything personally. After more meditation and devotion to the practice, you will experience cessation again. Then you'll see the links of dependent origination arise and pass away three times after a cessation moment in quick succession. This is the anagami magga path knowledge of the third stage of awakening. After you experience anagami magga, if you experience the same thing again, then anagami phala or fruition knowledge will arise three times. An anagami has very strong equanimity. Nothing disturbs you except sometimes some restlessness that arises. Whereas before, you might have reacted with some sensual desire, lust, hatred, or aversion. This is no longer the case. In addition, there isn't the slightest fear now because of the elimination of hatred. Fear is part of hatred. You will have destroyed the first five fetters completely. 1. Sakkaya ditti, personality, belief in an I or personal self, a soul. 2. Visakicca, skeptical doubt that the Dharma is the true way. 3. Silabhata paramasa, clinging to rites and rituals. 4. Kamaraga, sensual craving, lust. 5. Vyapada, ill will, hatred, anger, aversion, and fear. Now you are very balanced in mind. This is not some super conscious state, but simply the removal of most of the craving tanha from your mind. You are still you, and you still have your personality, but the influences of the craving, neurotic, fearful self, not there now. You can continue working at your job and be in the world. Work that is involved in honest, ethical pursuits will appeal to you. You'll be completely truthful and fair in your dealings with your customers and fellow employees. You will treat your fellow employees with kindness and not be shaken by any outbursts from the boss. You will notice that you are no longer bothered by the petty fears and hang-ups that most people experience. You'll become a better employee and a better boss. You will have no fear of anything and never be intimidated. You will follow directions perfectly but have no problem with pushing back against unwise orders given to you, and will not fear to talk to the boss in an even, unemotional way. You won't complain or gossip with other employees about what is wrong, and you might even be promoted up the ranks. Truly, worldly success will come as you achieve deep spiritual success. Romantic interest is removed in a major way at the path knowledge and eliminated entirely at the fruition knowledge 4. Anagami. You will no longer desire marriage or a family. However, if you currently are married or have a family, your romantic lust will be replaced with strong, pure loving kindness. You will live with your mate as best friends or brother and sister. You won't have any more children because your desire for sex will be lost. You'll be the most wonderful parent conceivable. You won't ever get mad. And you will always love and make plenty of time for your child. Your two-year-old won't get on your nerves anymore because you know that's the nature of a two-year-old. It's okay. You will acquire what you need and not what you want. You won't have big desires to do things other than being happy with what you have and what you are doing right now. You will want to share what you have learned in your meditation by teaching, but you won't be attached to promoting anything. If it happens, it happens. Your happiness with what you have achieved will be something you naturally want to share with others. If you are working, gradually you will move away from just doing a job to make money, to looking for ways to help people directly by starting a meditation group or teaching meditation full time. People will ask you what depression is or what suffering is, and you'll be able to tell them, with no doubts. You will know how your mind works and will be able to explain it to others. And best of all, going to the dentist won't bother you. You'll never be born again in the sensuous realms. If you don't attain Arahant in this lifetime, you'll be reborn in one of the five high Brahma realms called the Pure Abodes, where there are only other Anagamis and Arahants. For this realm, you are destined to attain Arahanthap and get off the wheel. But there is still more to do. There are 10 fetters, and you have removed 5. There are yet 5 more. These are the final obstacles to full awakening and freedom from even a wisp of craving. Chapter 18, Fourth Stage. Arahant. When you become an Arahant, there is nothing more that can disturb your mind. You will experience Arahatamagga and Arahatafala, path and fruition. With each path and each fruition experience, you'll witness the arising and passing away of the links of dependent origination 4 times very quickly. You will now have completely let go of all 10 fetters of being. There is no further mental suffering for you of any kind. 1. Sakkayaditti, personality, belief in an I or personal self, a soul, the realization of the total impersonality of all existence. 2. Visakicca, skeptical doubt that the correct practice of right effort is the true way to awakening. 3. Silabhata Paramasa, realizing that rites and rituals by themselves do not lead to awakening. 4. Kamaraga, craving for sensual pleasures. 5. Vyapada, ill will, hatred, and fear. 6. Ruparaga and Aruparaga, the desire for material and immaterial existence. The desire to be reborn in any realm of existence. This fetter listing has these 2 desires for existence combined into one, which is different from the way they are normally listed. Closing parenthesis. 7. Mana, conceit, comparing with somebody else. Thinking in your mind, I'm better than you, or I'm less than you. Comparing yourself to others. 8. Thina Midha, sloth and torpor, although sloth and torpor are frequently not classically included as part of the fetters, sloth and torpor are considered as one of the hindrances, which is why Bhante Vimilaram she added here. The suttas list this as a hindrance quite clearly. 9. Udaka, restlessness and worry. 10. Avijja, ignorance of the 4 noble truths and the workings of dependent origination. You will be sought out for your wisdom, as there is no craving left in your mind and your mind is completely transparent. You see how your mind works and can easily explain it to others. The Buddha was an Arahant and passed through all of the jhanas and went through all the stages of awakening. It is said you could ask the Buddha a question and he would give you the perfect answer. He always said exactly what was called for at the time. You may not have the depth of his understanding or ability to speak, but it will be close. You will have experienced Nibbana the same number of times, but your understanding of what you saw, your ability to explain it may be less. The difference between a Buddha and an Arahant is that the Buddha has gone through countless lifetimes of purification and can be compared to a bottle that is completely empty, clear and sparkling. There will be no taint or smell of what was there before. In an arahant, there may be just a whiff of the personality that was there before, like a milk bottle that is emptied and cleaned out, but with some faint remnant of what was there. Nonetheless, both a Buddha and an arahant are both empty of craving and ego. Both have the same attainments. Another difference here is that a Buddha comes to wisdom solely through their own efforts, while an arahant reaches awakening by hearing the teachings of a Buddha. When somebody asks you if you have any attachments to relatives or family, you will say no. There is nothing that makes your mind lose its balance. Yet arahants are not automatons. The Buddha was hardly an automaton. He not only responded to people who needed his help, but went from place to place finding beings with little dust in their eyes who he felt could understand his teachings. He initiated conversations, seeking out beings that he could help awaken. He invited other teachers to come and argue their views with him in order to teach more students and convince more people he knew the true way. It was said that he taught the devas and beings in other realms while everyone else was asleep at night. You will compassionately take care of any problem that you find. You will always help others to overcome problems, but will never push your help on them. You'll be equally compassionate to all beings and not just members of your family. Your loving kindness now knows no bounds or limits. You will treat the lowly ant as well as you treat your closest friend. You will not proselytize about Buddhism. You will answer questions and bring up Dharma at the right time. It is unlikely anyone would ever know about your attainment, as there is no longer conceit or desire to say you are better than anyone. And as far as you are concerned, your mind is simply clear, and that is all. There may arise in you some psychic powers, like reading minds or something else, but it just depends on your past karmic actions. Sariputta had little in the way of powers, yet he was an intellectual giant and called the general of the Dharma. Moggallana had every power that was possible, and then some. But his intellect was not as sharp, as he had more of a feeling or emotional type of personality. Feeling personalities have a strong tendency to be able to develop psychic powers. Your intuition about things will be exquisite. Your meditation practice will be very deep, with no distractions. You can decide to go into a jhana, or even cessation, nirada, itself at will. You'll be able to resolve to sit in the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness for up to 7 days. If you go any longer than that, your body will lose its heat and vitality and die. You must be careful. Going into a state of extended cessation is of great benefit, because when you come out of this state, your mind will be extremely energetic and awake. You will need much less sleep. The Buddha was said to have slept only an hour per night. People with the fruition of anagami also have limited ability to go into cessation, and there are now students that can make this determination and sit in cessation for as long as they wish. Theoretically, based on the suttas, you can sit for 7 full days and get up as if you had just recently sat down, with no pain, full of energy. The cessation state is different than what is mentioned in the suttas, as he attained to the cessation of perception, feeling and consciousness, and his taints were destroyed by seeing with wisdom. When this state is attained, you do not see the links arise and attain nibbana. It is simply a stilling and stopping of mind. Why one doesn't see the links again and attain nibbana again, I cannot say. All we can say is that there is a cessation, and there is a cessation different in some way. There is also a difference between the cessation state of an anagami versus an arahant. Cessation, or in Pali, nirada, is a stopping of the mental stream. Just like when you turn the water off from the faucet, and it drips a little bit and then stops, there is no more water. Nirada is the stopping of all mental activity. It is when mind becomes so tranquil that it just stops. However, the arahant's mind is so pure that when he determines to go into this cessation experience, it is a state closer to nibbana, an unconditioned state. It is not just a stopping, but something else. Instead of the conditioned mind stopping, Mind now moves toward the unconditioned. Bhikkhu Nanananda in his series The Mind Stilled in Sermon 16 goes into this subject and calls this state by its Pali name Arahatapala Samadhi. He explains it here. But the awakening in Nibbana is not of such a temporary character. Why? Because all the influxes that lead one into the samsaric slumber with its dreams of recurrent births are made extinct in the light of that perfect knowledge of realization. That is why the term asavakaya, extinction of influxes, is used in the discourses as an epithet of Nibbana. The arahants accomplish this feat in the concentration on the fruit of arahanthood, arahatapala samadhi. Bhante Vimalaramshi has traveled the world and talked to and studied under many of the recognized meditation masters of our time. He is inevitably asked if he has met any arahants. What about a fill in the blank? He says, no, so far he has not met anyone that he felt was an arahant. He says you need to spend time evaluating someone to be sure they have no more fetters. But he is hopeful that we will have one soon. You are at the end of the Eightfold Path. You have eliminated ignorance and craving through thoroughly understanding the Four Noble Truths. You have traveled the Eightfold Path to the end of suffering. You will live out your current life but will not be born again to the maelstrom of samsara and will not be subject to its disease. You have found freedom. You have become another noble one in the Buddha's dispensation. MN 21. Monks, rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, he has attained mastery and perfection in noble virtue, attained mastery and perfection in noble collectedness, attained mastery and perfection in noble wisdom, attained mastery and perfection in noble deliverance. It is of Sariputta indeed that, rightly speaking, this should be said. 22. Monks, rightly speaking, were it to be said of anyone, he is the son of the Blessed One, born of his breast, born of his mouth, born of the Dharma, created by the Dharma, an heir in the Dharma, not an heir in material things. It is of Sariputta indeed that, rightly speaking, this should be said. 23. Monks, the matchless wheel of the Dharma set rolling by the Tathagata is kept rolling rightly by Sariputta. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. In a bhikkhu whose taints are destroyed, these lust, hatred, delusion are abandoned, cut off at the root, made like a palm stump, done away with so that they are no longer subject to futur arising. Chapter 19. The Power of Jhana. Experiencing the state of jhana in this lifetime is a very powerful and far-reaching event that you can achieve pretty quickly in this lifetime. In fact, it is only second to attaining Nibbana itself. Why is it so important? It is important because that when you attain even one moment of jhana, the suttas say that if you keep your precepts and continue to lead a relatively moral life until your death, you'll be destined, at a minimum, to be reborn into a realm called a Brahmaloka. This is a very high heavenly realm that corresponds to the last and highest most jhana you have attained in your practice. For example, if the last and highest jhana you experienced during your lifetime was the third jhana, then you would be reborn into the third jhana realm of Brahmaloka. At the highest state degree in this realm, it is called the Devas of Refulgent Glory, Subhakina Deva. Because of the great merit to wholesome energy of the jhana, you'll never return to a human of the lower heaven realms, much less hell, ghosts or animal realms. Now, if that isn't good news, then there is an even more interesting fact that the suttas describe and is found in the Anguttara Nikaya. You will attain Nibbana there in that realm, without any return to a lower realm. Not only are you reborn into a Brahmaloka, but you never take rebirth in any lower realm, even if you have not attained Nibbana. And all it took was to experience jhana just once. This should motivate you to go sit. It is widely written in most books on Buddhism that should you attain Sotapanna, or higher attainment, that you will return at most 7 times to any realm before attaining final Nibbana or Arahantship. But it can actually only be as little as 1 time if you attain Nibbana through the jhana practice. Note, this is the tranquil aware jhana state we are talking About you'll be only reborn one time in the highest jhana realm that you experienced and attain final awakening there. There are subtle references to support this coming up, but first, we must address a common misconception that you must actually be in the state of jhana while you are dying to be reborn into that higher realm, attaining jhana just one time. The suttas to say that if you attain a jhana, then you are automatically reborn into the corresponding Brahmaloka realm and never return back to a lower realm. However, most people think that when you die you have to be in the state of jhana. The thought is that if you attain the first jhana, then rebirth is in the first jhana realm. Rebirth is very pleasant and is 1 eon long there. If you attain the second jhana, then this realm is higher still, and so on up to the 8th level of the arupa base of neither perception nor non-perception. I'll use the below sutta, it is a suttacentral.net translation, but I'm going to change some of the text to Bhikkhu Bodhi's version. This becomes clearer with his Anguttara Nikaya translation, printed by Wisdom Publications in 2012, on page 507. This is a sutta entitled Goodwill, Loving Kindness, the Book of Fours, Sutta 125. This is to address the skeptics that think that to be reborn in a Brahmaloka requires that you be in the jhana meditation state at the moment of your death. Anguttara Nikaya 125, 5, Book of Fours, Loving Kindness. Monks, there are these four types of individuals to be found existing in the world. Which four? There is the case where an individual keeps pervading the first direction as well as the second direction, the third and the fourth, with an awareness imbued with loving kindness or metta. Thus, he keeps pervading above, below, and all around. Everywhere and in every respect the all-encompassing cosmos with an awareness imbued with goodwill, loving kindness. Abundant, expansive, a measure of BLE, free from hostility, free from ill will. He savors that, longs for that, finds satisfaction through that, staying there, fixed on that, dwelling there often, not falling away from that, DJ easily able to return to that jhana, then when he dies he reappears in conjunction with the devas of Brahma's retinue. First jhana realm, the devas of Brahma's retinue, monks, have a lifespan of an eon. If we look at the sutta, this idea of having to be in the jhana state at death appears not to be the case, luckily. You only need to be able to experience in the time period that is near your death, through a normal sitting, the ability to get back into that jhana again. With this condition, you have fulfilled the criteria. The only exception would be if you had committed any of the five heinous crimes, killing an arahant, killing your mother or father, causing a schism in the Sangha, or wounding a Buddha, all of which are either impossible or extremely unlikely. As long you meet these criteria, you'll be reborn into, for example, that very pleasant first jhana realm. And if you are able to attain the first jhana in the time period around your death, then you'll be assured of being reborn into that realm. It doesn't say you have to be in the jhana at the moment of death. Who could actually accomplish that anyway? You are dying. You may be sick and weak. It would take a Buddha, but then he is already fully enlightened and it would not apply to him. Anyway, most meditator TWIM students would likely be able to get into a jhana easily enough later on in life if they have kept the practice up, or at least led a moral life and kept precepts. It's like getting on a bike. The next part is now subject to more interpretation, and I will do my best to help with this. The sutta says that whatever jhana realm that you are reborn into, having arrived in that realm by your jhana practice, you will attain nibbana in that realm, never to return to any lower realm, or for that matter any realm at all. But it starts off with saying that someone other than the Buddha's disciples will go to the lower realms immediately after having enjoyed that high rebirth. Continued, Anguttara Nikaya 125, 5, Book of Fours, Loving Kindness. A run-of-the-mill, worldling person, having stayed there, having used up all the lifespan of those devas, goes to hell, too. The animal womb, to the state of the hungry shades, ghosts. But a disciple of the Blessed One, below it says noble disciple, so this means following the Buddha's training in the aware jhanas, not concentration jhanas, having stayed there, having used up all the lifespan of those devas, is unbound, attains final nibbana, right in that state of being. This, monks, is the difference, this the distinction, this the distinguishing factor, between an educated disciple of the noble ones, those having practiced the jhana path that the Buddha found, and an uneducated run-of-the-mill person, a disciple of another system of meditation, like absorption concentration. The Buddha tried them all before finding the aware jhana path, when there is future destiny and rebirth. The sutta implies that if you attain jhana and you have learned true meditation practice from the Buddha, then you'll be reborn into the jhana realm, and attain final nibbana in that realm and get off the wheel right there, with no further births. However, there is this quite ominous warning, and believe me, most people will not like this at all, about your subsequent rebirth after having been reborn into a jhana realm if you did not learn your meditation from the Buddha. If you attain jhana using concentration methods taught by other teachers, the Buddha, he rejected concentration methods early on in his search, you'll indeed be reborn to this Brahmaloka and live out your life there, but, shockingly, you will not gracefully fall down from the Brahmaloka to a Devara heavenly realm, and then gently are reborn into a human birth, as your good karma and merit is used up, but, rather, fall directly into the lower planes of existence like the animal hell realms. This does not agree with the Abhidhamma, which most monks would consult for this type of inquiry. In fact, there is disagreement about whether the Abhidhamma was spoken by the Buddha at all. It is generally theorized by many scholars that it was added to the basket of texts at the Third Council of Monks, some 200 years after the Buddha died. So, how could he have said this? So, if we go by the suttas only, then we need to change our views. After explaining this sutta to one of our more advanced students in the USA, he said he did recall one of his past lives in a Brahmaloka heaven realm, and he remembered actually dying from the realm. He was shocked to find he had fallen all the way down to become an animal in his next rebirth, from a god to a dog. A Sri Lankan student at Dharmasuka for a retreat agreed with this idea and quoted a sutta reference, I don't recall now, where the Buddha is asked about a stream of ants walking on the ground. He said that these beings had fallen from a Brahmaloka and had not gotten off the wheel and attained Nibbana. The Buddha pointed this out as an admonishment to Sariputta, who had just gotten someone on the deathbed into a wholesome enough state for rebirth after death into a heavenly Deva realm. The admonishment was for only getting them into a heavenly realm and not giving them enough wisdom for them to attain the knowledge of Nibbana right there and get off the wheel, either this or only one more lifetime. If you attain a few absorption concentration jhanas, then eventually that karma runs out, and it really runs out. You might become an ant after your stay in a heavenly palace. I'll note here that I believe the above example may be a student that only attained the Brahmaloka through an act of good merit, not attaining any jhanas, but only was listening to Sariputta, and through their giving ear, the mind became elevated enough to get into a Brahmaloka through the hearing of a sutta. Because it was not through jhana practice, there would be no protection from falling from that realm. There are stories of people acquiring enough merit at the time of the Buddha to be reborn, even as high as the Brahmalikas. But due to not having any jhana practice to protect them, either concentration or tranquil aware jhana, they fell directly to the lower realms, as that was the only good merit keeping them in the higher realm. I don't know, all this is speculation, but let's go to the sutta. PG 347, Imperturbable 116, 4 Anguttara Nikaya BB 2012. Monks, there are three types of persons found in this world. 1. Here, monks with the attainment of the base of infinite space, this person relishes it and finds satisfaction in it. If he is firm in dot and has not lost it when he dies, he is reborn in companionship with the devas of the infinite space. The lifespan is 20,000 eons. This worldling remains there all his life, and when he has completed the entire lifespan of those devas, he goes down to hell, to the animal realm too. The sphere of afflicted spirits. But the Blessed One's disciple remains there all his life, and when he has completed his entire lifespan of those devas, he attains Nibbana in that very same state of existence. This is the difference between the instructed Noble One's disciple and the worldling. The Sutta goes on to repeat for the base of infinite consciousness and nothingness. So this is saying that if you are able to enter into a jhana, in this specific case, an arupa jhana at death, and you have not arrived at this realm through wrong concentration or because of a large amount of worldly merit, then you are liable to fall sharply, for that realm, directly into a lower realm, without gradually falling first into a deva realm, and then again further down to a human realm. This doesn't say a noble disciple, it says the Blessed One's disciple. Just a disciple is all. This means they are someone following the jhana practice path laid out by the Buddha. They don't have any attainments. As if they did, they would be referred to as a noble disciple. In summary, I leave you with some quotes from the suttas to suggest it is up to the reader to decide that if you keep up your meditation practice and are able to get into a jhana near and around the time of your death, then you will not only be reborn into the corresponding Brahmaloka but attain Nibbana there without ever returning to a lower rebirth. Pretty good. Again, this is commonly thought as only the domain of the stream enterer or a higher noble disciple. It was thought that you had to have the third stage Nibbana experience to never return to this world a lower. In fact, all you need to do is just attain a jhana. This is a wonderful discovery, and if true, we are very lucky, even for those whose practice is only a little bit advanced, with just the first jhana attained. That said, the Buddha always admonished followers not ever to stop and to continue the practice until final awakening was achieved here and now. He had high expectations and demanded the highest achievement. Either you were an arahant, or you were still a rookie. Jhananagamiya Jhananagamita. Reading through the Anguttara Nikaya is quite interesting, as there are some nuggets in these texts that don't appear elsewhere in the other Nikayas. What I found, specifically, is a different understanding or definition of the Sotapanna and Sakadagami noble disciples, first and second level attainments. It is thought that only an Anagami attainment, third stage of awakening, will give you enough merit for your rebirth in your next lifetime to be reborn in a Brahmaloka, and in the case of the Anagami, a very special Brahmaloka called the Pure Abodes, where only Anagamis are reborn because they have eliminated the first five fetters of craving. For that they attain arahantship in that realm and never take birth again. It is an incredible accomplishment for this to be your last lifetime in the lower realms, even the human and deva realms. And this is what the Anagami achieves. However, I found some good news for the first two lower noble levels. In the Anguttara Nikaya, for the first two noble disciples, if you attain Sotapanna or Sakadagami, and you did this through the jhana meditation practice, then you'll be reborn into the Brahmalokas, never to return, like the Anagami. The first and second paths can be attained through hearing a sutta. However, when you attain them with jhana practice, your advantage is that you are reborn into the highest realm available to a meditator. You will not return to any lower realm. You will attain Nibbana in that realm and get off the wheel right there. No more lifetimes, like seven lives for a Sotapanna and one for a Sakadagami, which is the case described in so many commentaries. Those noble disciples that have the attainment of Sotapanna or Sakadagami that was attained through the jhana practice are given a unique title of Jhananagamiya Jhananagamita Pabhikkhu Bodhis. Notes from a commentary he does note in his translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, notes number 539 and number 2193, which I reproduce later. Let's go to the suttas. Here is a partial sutta quote regarding the never returner status of Sotapanna or Sakadagami. Pg. 1541, the deed-born body, 219, 9 and This noble disciple understands when the liberation of mind by loving kindness has been developed in this way, who has attained the jhanas through the Brahmaviharas, it leads to non-returning for a wise bhikkhu here who does not penetrate to a further liberation. A similar sutta is found on p. 327, autumn 94, 3 an. Bhikkhus, just as, in the autumn, when the sky is clear and cloudless, the sun, ascending in the sky, dispels all darkness from space as it shines and beams and radiates, so too, when the dust-free, stainless Dharma arises in the noble disciple, together with the arising of vision, the noble disciple abandons three fetters, person, existence, view, doubt, and wrong grasp of behavior and observance. Afterward, when he departs from two states, longing and ill will, then secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and dwells in the first jhana, which consists of rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, accompanied by thought and examination. If Bhikkhus, the noble disciple, should pass away on that occasion, there is no fetter bound by which he might return to this world. The above person clearly becomes free of three fetters and has become a Sotapanna. Bhikkhu Bodhi explains in a note number 539. Page 1663, relating to the above passage, he calls this type of individual a Jhananagami, or as in the duplicate note number 2193, a Jhananagamita. Here is the note number 2193, page 1859 by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This phrase normally denotes the attainment of non-returning. MP commentaries, however, identifies this disciple as a jhana non-returner, jhana nagamita, that is, a stream enter or once returner who also attains jhana. Though such a practitioner has not yet eliminated the two fetters of sensual desire and ill will, by attaining jhana, he or she is bound to be reborn in the form realm and attain nibbana there, without taking another rebirth in the sense sphere. I will note here, myself, that I don't know what the difference is between the two types of jhananagamas. It is not explained by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So, now we have a new type of noble one that has attained Sotapanna and Sakadagami, attained by following the jhana meditation system, not attained through listening to a phrase or other method. He has earned the achievement of not having to be born again in the lower Devara human realms and will be reborn in a Brahmaloka and attain final Nibbana there. It says the form realm, and I would theorize that this is the pure abodes, as this is the highest form realm. Otherwise, logically, if you do attain to the Arupa jhanas, which you would do practicing by using the jhana path, then you would be reborn in the higher Arupa mental Brahmalikas, where there is only mind, i.e. the base of nothingness, etc. This would not be a birth in a form realm, but rather, a formless realm. This seems fairly logical, as it would make no sense for someone who attained Sotapanna to be reborn again as a human being, with the same people they grew up with, the same high school dance party that they went to, the same people who never knew or followed precepts. No, I don't think that makes sense. A Sotapanna is a very high being, called a sat in many places, and it would be very doubtful that he, she would be reborn into the company of worldlings, even reborn as a regular monk, among monks who, themselves, are still worldlings. Many monks these days are study monks, or serve lay people performing rites and rituals and have not meditated. I will leave all these ideas in the last chapter to contemplate, but I found it rather interesting and hopeful. It may be quite confusing, but I seem to have become a true Buddhist geek, as I am interested in the finer, perhaps really, really finer points of attainments. This research, of course, is solely based on what the suttas say, which I would hope to be true and correct. The interpretation, of course, is just my own. Chapter 20, After the Retreat. People ask after a retreat, or what they think is a major attainment, now what do I do? How do I practice each day? First, one of the misunderstandings is that you'll be able to dial up the last jhana you attained, or for that matter, any jhana at will. No, you won't be able to do that. Your practice will take a dip and the mind will sink back into a coarser state. Daily life brings stresses, both physical and emotional. These will tire you out and will affect your meditation. All of the news, social media and relationships you have will make your mind more restless and agitated. So, your meditation will be restless one day and groggy the next. Sometimes you will just be frazzled. It doesn't matter, you just continue your practice each day, as long as you can. Bhante Vimalaram, she suggests, if you want true progress each day, you will sit and walk 2 hours or more. Most people will not have that time to spend, but can sit 30 minutes or an hour each day. So do that. Get up a little earlier to sit. Progress will continue, albeit slower. Every day, the more pure mind states you bring up, the more mental merit and purity you obtain. It is suggested that you get up in the morning and go through your morning things like a bath and having breakfast and then sit. Sitting right away when you get up may lead to sleepiness. If you were working with a spiritual friend as your object of meditation, then continue that process. When your feeling of metta arises up into your head and ceases being in your heart or chest area, then go to the breaking down the barriers section in this book and practice that for a day or two. When your mind is okay with the four groups of beings, and you don't have any gross ill will, then continue on to radiating in the six directions. Practice and start with radiating loving kindness per the instructions in that section. See the fourth jhana chapter in this book for all of the above instructions. If you have advanced and were practicing at the formless jhana levels of either metta, karuna, mudita or upekkha, then on a retreat you would just return and work with the jhana feeling you were working with. However, in daily life, you would be advised to start each meditation session with metta or loving kindness. This is the gateway to all of the other jhanas. Many students will get into equanimity on a retreat and experience all of the higher jhanas and, perhaps, get an attainment. They think that they simply can return to radiating equanimity during daily life. This might not be possible. If you start radiating equanimity, you may actually just be radiating a kind of calm, which is really not equanimity at all, and your practice won't get anywhere. This might leave you frustrated and wondering why nothing is happening. Off retreat, your mind is agitated and restless, and no longer in a high state, so it is best to restart with metta. This loving kindness that is radiated outward softens the mind and brings tranquility and energy, joy to your sitting. In a very short time, your mind will return to the last level you attained. Remember, the Brahmavihara practice is something that happens automatically. No need to figure this out, just start with metta, and you'll go up the chain of viharas. If you are doing directions, you can do 5 minutes to each direction, as you did previously. If you have had an attainment, you are suggested to radiate only 2 minutes in each direction and then all around. Then, the rest of the day use your 6 rupees to release and relax into disturbing mental states that might be triggered. Try radiating loving kindness while you are driving or shopping. Develop wholesome states. The longer you stay in the wholesome, the deeper your practice will go, eventually. Keep your precepts. This is very important for your practice to go further. Avoid intoxicants, especially, as that might be the tougher precept to keep than the others. Peer pressure can come into play here, but just wave it off. This will have significant payoffs for you in the future. Develop your dana or generosity. Give more to your local sangha. Give more in general. This softens the mind further and makes merit that will affect your practice positively. And, of course, continue to sit. Meditate, Ananda, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. End notes. The path to Nibbana. Biography. David Johnson has been in residence at Dharmasukha Meditation Center since 2010. He is a long-time senior student of Bhante Vimalaram Shi and has participated in many retreats. Currently, he is a Kapiya personal attendant for Ven. Bhante Vimalaramshi, when resides at the center. David also did a temporary ordination in 2012 under Bhante Vimalaramshi. He took on the robes for a short period. History. David was a student of many Vipassana retreats using the Mahasi method, starting from the age of 19. He spent nearly 20 years taking yearly retreats. He also has completed over 12 retreats with Bhante Vimalaramshi and has been his student since 2006. David has taken and accumulated video footage of and personally met Upamara and Mahasi Sayadaw. He previously meditated under Joseph Goldstein, Jack Hornfield, and Usilananda. He has brought the footage of these great teachers to the internet for all to enjoy. David is from Bellevue, near Seattle, Washington. From 1973 to 1978, he was the Meditation Center Retreat Manager for the Still Point Institute, a San Jose, California-based Vipassana Center. He assisted in the growth of the center and managed its financial and administrative affairs. From the 1980s to 2010, he worked in the San Francisco Bay Area at several networking companies as a production and logistics manager. He then decided to join Bhante in his mission to bring TWIM to the world in 2010 and moved to Missouri on a permanent basis. In 2015, he wrote, using Bhante Vimalaramshi's introductory talks and meditator experiences, the recent instruction book, A Guide to Tranquil Wisdom Meditation. His current duties at Dharmasuka include serving as secretary, treasurer, and board member, guiding monthly online retreats since 2015 and now on-site retreats, managing the retreat center, maintaining the website and social media accounts, producing books, publishing all Bhante's recent books, producing videos, producing all footage of Bhante found on the website and on YouTube. You can directly get in touch with David at david@dharmasuka.org or reach him through the Dharmasuka website. Resources. Dharmasuka Meditation Center website, link. Majjhima Nikaya, translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, Somerville, M.A., Wisdom Publications, 1995. Kraft, Doug, Buddha's Map, His Original Teachings on Awakening, Ease, and Insight in the Heart of Meditation. Grass Valley. CA, Blue Dolphin Publishing. 2013. Vimalaramshi, Bhante, The Anapanasati Sutta, A Practical Guide to Mindfulness of Breathing in Tranquil Wisdom Meditation. Carmel, NY, Buddhist Association of the USA. 2006. Vimalaramshi, Bhante, Meditation is Life, Life is Meditation. Annapolis, Mo, Dharmasuka, 2014. Vimalaramshi, Bhante, Breath of Love, Jakarta, Indonesia, F.E. Pasiko Foundation, 2012. Vimalaramshi, Bhante, Moving Dharma, Volume 1, Annapolis, Mo, Dharmasuka, 2012. Vimalaramshi, Bhante, A Guide to Tranquil Wisdom Meditation, TWIM, Annapolis, Mo, Dharmasuka, 2016. Orders. Available from most online bookstores. Local bookstores can order it for you. Book Depository will ship books anywhere in the world for free. www.bookdepository.com. Meditation questions welcome at email david@dharmasuka.org. Addendum. Guide to Forgiveness Meditation. An effective method to dissolve blocks to loving kindness and living in the present. Bhante Vimalaramshi. Introduction. The Buddha was a meditation teacher. He taught meditation for 45 years after he became fully awakened. When you study and practice meditation, you'll not be entirely successful until you master the definitions and interwoven nature of two words, meditation and mindfulness. I can give you the definitions, but then you must experience for yourself how these two work together. In the Buddhist teachings, meditation means observing the movement of mind's attention moment to moment in order to see clearly how the link's dependent origination actually work. Mindfulness means remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. This use of mindfulness actually causes mind to become sharper as you go. experience more subtle states of mind. It isn't hard to see why you must develop this precise mindfulness to keep the meditation going smoothly. Many people practice loving-kindness meditation, but, according to a few people, the power of it doesn't seem to change much for them in their daily lives. If it doesn't take off quite right in the beginning, we might run into difficulty with this practice, and it can be like hitting a wall. It's good to know that there is a key to the solution for developing metta in our daily activities. That solution is learning to smile as much as you can remember. Apparently, in some cases, if we do get into trouble, we can clear the runway for our mindfulness of loving-kindness to take off by first learning to use mindfulness of forgiveness meditation. This is an extremely powerful and cleansing practice. Forgiveness is a form of loving-kindness that really clears our mind of negative or unwholesome states. The reason this book came into being is because of the many questions teachers are asked about why doesn't my metta arise easily. It is because we need to forgive ourselves first before we can send out pure love to others. Chapter 1. Preparation. At times, there can be confusion about how to effectively practice this mindfulness of forgiveness meditation. So, this booklet is dedicated only to this meditation on forgiveness so you can begin the practice with a clear goal and better understanding. When people are practicing loving-kindness meditation, you might run into a barrier as you try to send out loving-kindness to yourself and to others. If this happens after a few days and you are not successful in feeling the metta in the retreat, it may be suggested for you to take a step back and start doing the forgiveness meditation to overcome these blocks. After all, we cannot sincerely send loving-kindness and forgiveness to someone else when we do not have it for ourselves. This practice is not just used for a person pursuing loving-kindness and compassion meditation. Any person can make the commitment to clean house by doing this forgiveness work. After this is done for the first time, one feels many years younger, because oftentimes a great weight has been lifted off your heart and mind. Some people have the idea that this meditation is a completely different kind of meditation from the loving-kindness meditation. That is not so. It should be made clear from the beginning that the forgiveness meditation is not outside of the development of loving-kindness and is a part of metta. For anyone who has difficulty in feeling loving-kindness, this can be the first step. It creates a firm bridge between heart and mind that is then used to help all other kinds of meditation succeed. It is a cleansing for the heart, another opening of the heart we can add to our initial practice of generosity. In truth, this meditation is probably the most powerful meditation that I know. It can clear away mental blocks that pop up from old attachments or dislikes towards various people or events that happened to you in your past life experiences. If you follow directions closely, and you are patient when you practice, then pain and suffering will gradually dissolve any hard-heartedness you still carry in your mind about past life wounds. When you practice forgiveness meditation, all of the basic rules will remain the same. You still sit in a reasonably quiet space to do this work. Be sure you are wearing loose, comfortable clothing. Sit in a comfortable position on the floor or in a chair. If you do use a chair, don't lean into the back of the chair. Sit with your spine nicely straight, but not tightly erect. Sit in a position that does not bring up physical pain in general for you. You should follow the basics of practicing right effort using tranquil wisdom inside meditation, TWIM, and the 6 rupees for your meditation cycle to accomplish your goal. When you practice, sit for a minimum of 30 minutes each time. Sit longer if things are going smoothly and you have the time. At whatever time you decide to break your sitting, stand up slowly. Keep your observation going as you stand up. Stretch slowly if desired. While you are sitting, do not move at all. Don't wiggle your toes, don't scratch. If your body needs to cough or sneeze, do not hold this in, just sneeze or cough. Keep some tissues close by for any tears that might arise. If tears do fall, then let them come. That is what you have holes in your eyelids for. So let the tears come out. This releases pressure Consider this the cleansing time before you take up any other primary meditations. While practicing forgiveness meditation, please use only these meditation instructions and put all other meditation instructions aside until you have completed the work. This just means that we don't want to confuse mind, so don't mix up the recipe. We want only the information needed to do this practice. Chapter 2, Instructions. The way you start practicing forgiveness meditation is by forgiving yourself. There are different kinds of statements that you can use for this to help bring up any old grudges and hard-heartedness locked inside you. You may pick one statement to begin, and then you stay with that statement for a period of time, too. Give it a chance to settle in anew and see what comes up. The first suggested phrase is, I forgive myself for not understanding. Everybody has misunderstandings that happen in the life. Nobody is exempt from this fact. While you are sitting, you repeat the phrase, I forgive myself for not understanding. After you've done that, you put that feeling into your heart and stay with that feeling of forgiveness. When that feeling fades away, or the mind gets distracted, then you come back and forgive yourself for not understanding again. If you are familiar with the 6R process, you should 6R any distractions arise. The appendix has a large section on how you practice the 6 rupees. For those familiar with the jhanas and have meditated before, it is necessary to not go higher than the first jhana. You can't mentally verbalize beyond that. Say your phrases for forgiveness. Please make a determination to not go any deeper. This is an active contemplative process that we are doing now. While you're doing this, your mind is going to have some resistance to this meditation. Your mind is going to take off and say, well, this is stupid. I shouldn't be doing this. Reactions like these are part of your attachments. These are the obstacles that we must dissolve. Stay with your statement and repeat, I forgive myself for not understanding. Then your mind might say, ah, I don't need to do this anymore. This meditation doesn't work. Every thought that pulls you away from forgiving yourself for not understanding is an attachment and has to be let go, and the tension and tightness in that attachment must be relaxed away. This is where you use the 6Rs you learned with your basic metta meditation practice. The 6Rs are recognize, release greater than, relax, re-smile, return, repeat. That is the entire cycle. You recognize that mind is distracted. You release the distraction by not keeping your attention on it. You relax the tightness in your head and heart and you re-smile, and then you softly come back to the statement, and you stay with the statement for as long as you can. If you are distracted again, you repeat the process. It doesn't matter how many times your mind gets distracted. One thing that many people get caught with is getting wrapped up in the story about things, and this can cause lots of pain and suffering along with some frustration. The 6Rs will help you to see how strong the attachments are, and it shows the way to overcome the suffering they cause. Recognize it, let it be, relax, smile, come back and stay with the feeling of forgiveness for as long as you can. Sitting should be followed by walking practice. If you are going to continue sitting again, or you are going to return to a task in daily life, before you do, take a stroll at a normal pace to keep your blood flowing nicely. Walk for about 15 minutes minimum in some fresh air. 45 minutes is a good maximum time for walking. If you are working in a restricted space setting, find a space that is level and at least 30 feet long in length. Walk back and forth and mentally keep your meditation going. Asterisk, when you walk, you want to walk in a way that you repeat the phrases with each stride as you walk. Like this with the left foot, take a step and mentally say, I, then a right step, forgive, and left, you. Then again, but say, you, on the right step, and then left step, forgive, right step, me, and repeat. Back and forth. You can experiment and see what works. It can get into a nice cadence, but all the while it is really getting it into your noggin to forgive. I forgive you. You forgive me, and keep smiling when you're doing this. And 6R anything or anyone who comes up. Stay with E. Walking. I used to go for 6 to 8 mile walks in Hawaii doing just this practice. The idea of sitting and walking is to create a continuous flow of meditation without stopping. This proves you can keep the meditation with you all the time in life. While walking at this normal pace, continue doing the forgiveness meditation. With your eyes looking down towards the ground about 6 or 7 feet in front of you. Do not look around, keep on gently forgiving, keep smiling all the time. Chapter 3, Attachments. One mistake that an awful lot of people make is they say, well, meditation is just for sitting. The rest of the time I don't have anything else to do, so I can let my mind act like it always does. This is a mistake. We need to consider the idea that meditation is life and life is meditation. You want to realize that you have attachments in your daily life and just because you are not sitting doesn't mean those attachments aren't there. The whole point in doing the meditation is for personality development. It's for letting go of old habitual suffering bhava and in place of this developing a mind that has equanimity in it. The more resistance your mind has in doing this, the more you need to do it because the resistance is your mind showing you where your attachment is and that is the cause of suffering. This meditation works better than anything that I know of. For letting go of attachments, letting go and relaxing of old hard-hearted feelings, bhava, letting go of the way you think the world is supposed to be so you can start accepting the way the world actually is. Your mind might say, well, I don't like that. I don't like the way they said this or that. Ask yourself now, who doesn't like it? Who is judging and condemning? Who is making up a story? Who is caught by their attachment? Well, I am. It might be helpful here to give a definition of attachment. An attachment is anything we take personally, any thought, any feeling, any sensation. When we think these thoughts or feelings are mine, this is me, this is who I am, at that point, mind has become attached, and this causes craving to arise in your mind and body. Craving always manifests as a tension, a tightness in both mind and body. Craving is the I like it, I don't like it mind, which arises in everyone's mind-body process. Attachment is another word for craving and is the start of all suffering. When we see that everything that arises is part of an impersonal process, then we begin to understand what it is like to see things with a clear observant mind. Somebody might say something very innocently, and you hear it through your attachment, and it's negative. This is why we have to learn how to become aware of what is happening all the time in our daily lives. When you get finished sitting in your meditation for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, or for an hour and you start walking around, what does your mind do? It takes off just like it always does. It thinks about this. It thinks about that. This is just nonsense thoughts. Most of us think those thoughts and those feelings that arise are ours personally, that they're not just random things. But in truth, if you feed any kind of a thought or feeling with your attention, you make it bigger and more intense. When you realize that you are causing your own suffering, you have to forgive yourself for doing that. This means saying, I forgive myself for not understanding. I forgive myself completely. Of course, your mind is going to take off again and say, ah, this is stupid, this is nothing, this isn't real, this isn't what is actually happening. I don't want to do this. Every one of those thoughts is an attachment, isn't it? Every one of those thoughts has craving in it, doesn't it? Every one of those thoughts is causing you suffering, right? Because of this, you have to recognize that you are doing this to yourself and let go of those thoughts. That's just nonsense stuff anyway. It doesn't have anything to do with what you are doing and where you are right now. Once you know this, you forgive yourself for not understanding, for causing yourself pain, for causing other people pain. You really forgive. Take a look at when you are walking from here to there. What are you doing with your mind? Ho-hum, thinking about this. And I got to do that, and I have to go talk to that person, and I have to do this, all of that's nonsense. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't plan what you need to do next. You can, but just do that planning one time as your primary topic in the present moment. After you make up your mind what the plan is, you don't have to think about it. anymore. Repeating it, rolling it around again, all of that is just part of your old habitual tendency, bhava in Pali. It is your old conditioned thoughts and feelings, and taking them personally and causing yourself pain and suffering. Chapter 4, Daily Practice. Including the exercise of forgiveness in your daily activity is by far the most important part of this meditation. You forgive yourself continually for not understanding, for getting caught up in this or that, for taking things personally. How many times have you found yourself doing this? Hey, I don't like the way you said that, ask yourself. Who doesn't? Like what? Well, you said something that was hurtful, to whom? You need to stop and realize that you're taking all this stuff personally and it's not really personal. It's just stuff that happens. Forgive it. Forgive it even when you're walking along a road and you happen to kick a rock and it hurts. Forgive the pain for being there. Your job is to keep your mind forgiving all the time. That's what mindfulness of forgiveness meditation practice is all about. The technique is not just about when you are sitting. This is a life practice. This is an all-the-time practice. If you want to really begin to change, you have to be willing to go through the forgiveness sincerely, because it will help. You change a lot. You have to have patience, and it helps to have a sense of humor about just how dumb mind can be. The more you smile and laugh, the easier the meditation becomes. Chapter 5, Finding Balance. Whenever you personally continue to think about this and that, to judge this and condemn that, you are constantly causing yourself suffering. You don't need to do that. You want to argue with other people about your attachments. What's the point? When you really start practicing forgiveness for yourself, or forgiveness for another person, your mind starts to get into balance, and your sense of humor begins to change. This is equanimity. Then you don't take thoughts, feelings, and sensations and all this other stuff personally. When you practice in this way, you are seeing life for what it is and allowing it to be there. It's not worth going over it in your mind, and over it, and over it, and over it. It's not worth it. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of effort. Every time you have a repeated thought, you are attached. You're identifying with that thought, and you're taking it personally, and that is again the cause of suffering. What you see here is the second noble truth. You are witnessing how craving, taking it personally, is the cause of suffering. And you can't blame anybody else for it. It's yours. You are doing it all to yourself. Well, they said this. So what? Others may have their opinion. That doesn't mean I have to listen to them. I don't have to take it in personally and analyze whether it's correct or not, because it doesn't matter. The more you forgive in your daily life and daily activities, the easier it is to forgive the big things that happened in the past. Chapter 6, Persistence. When you're doing the forgiveness meditation while you're sitting, you're staying with one of the suggested statements. You stay with that one statement until you internally feel, yes, I really do forgive myself for not understanding. It's important to work this through. To really forgive can take a while. It's not just some quick fix to do in one sitting and then you come in and say, okay, now I'm done, or you say, I've already done that. Doing that is not where you're going to get real change. Nope. You still have your attachments there. You still have to continually forgive yourself for not understanding. Forgive yourself for making a mistake. That is what not understanding is about. You have to forgive yourself for judging, for condemning, for analyzing, for thinking, for getting angry. Forgive everything, all of the time. When I started to do the forgiveness meditation, which I did personally for myself for 2 years, because I wanted to make sure I really understood this meditation, I went through major changes. There were major changes, major personality changes. If you want that for yourself, you have to have the kind of patience. This idea of, well, I've already forgiven this person or that person, that simply isn't it. A little later on you figure out that you're talking about how you didn't like this or that from them. Guess what? Who hasn't finished their forgiveness meditation? You haven't forgiven yourself or that other person. Chapter 7, Going Deeper. When you start to go deeper in your meditation, staying with the forgiveness, and you do forgive yourself for making mistakes, there can come a time when somebody comes up into your mind that you need to forgive. When this happens, you realize that you did not ask them to come up. You do not stop and say, well, I need this person to come up, they came up by themselves. As soon as that person comes up, you start forgiving them for not understanding. It doesn't matter what they did in the past. All of your thoughts, all of your opinions of what they did in the past just keep bringing up more suffering. These thoughts come up because of your attachment. I didn't like that. I didn't want that to happen. They are a dirty no. Good so and so because they did that to me. Can you guess where the attachment is? Guess where the idea comes from that? I can blame somebody else for my own suffering. The only person you can blame for your suffering is yourself. Why? Because you are the one that took it personally. You're the one who had an opinion about it. You're the one that used your habitual tendencies over and over again to justify the idea that I'm right and you're wrong. That's how we cause our own suffering. The forgiveness meditation helps you let go of that opinion, that idea, that attachment, and feel some relief. Because some past person did or said something that caused anger, resentment, jealousy, pain, or whatever the catch of the day was, it can have a real tendency for your mind to get caught up in thinking about that past event. This is called getting caught by the story. You need to use the 6 R's and then go back to your forgiveness statement. It doesn't matter how many times the story arises, please use the 6 R's and then forgive again. The story's emotion will fade away after you do this enough. This is where patience is needed. Chapter 8, Letting Go. When you see someone else come up in your mind, somebody you really had a rough time with and you didn't like it, someone you started hating for whatever reason, you forgive them. With your mind's eye, you look them straight in their eyes and you tell them sincerely, I forgive you for not understanding the situation. I forgive you for causing me pain. I forgive you completely. Now, keep that person in your heart and radiate forgiveness to them. If your mind has a distraction and it pulls you away for that, you might hear in your mind, no, I don't, that no good so and so. I won't forgive him. Using the 6 R's, let go of this and come back and say, I do forgive you. It has to be sincere. Well, I'm not going to forgive the dirty no good so and so. Why not? Because they caused me suffering. Oops, who caused his suffering? You caused your own self-suffering because you took it personally, and you reinforced that with a lot of thoughts and opinions and ideas about why that was wrong. In other words, you were caught in your craving, your own clinging, your habitual tendencies, and that leads to more and more dissatisfaction, aversion, pain, and suffering. Chapter 9, Relief. It's really important to realize that this is not an easy practice. It's hard to forgive someone when they have really caused you harm. Take a woman that has been raped or a man who has been beaten and robbed. It's hard to forgive the person who raped them or beat them because they have been violated. But holding on to the hatred of that person is keeping them attached. It doesn't matter what the action was. It doesn't matter what happened in the past. What matters is what you are doing with what you have in your mind right now. To completely develop this practice to the highest level means that you keep forgiving and forgiving over and over. With your mind's eye, you look them straight in the eye and you say, I really do forgive you. And your mind says, no, I don't. And you let that go and 6 R's and come back. You say, I really do forgive you. Then you take that person and put them into your heart and continue to radiate forgiveness to them. How long do you do that? As long as it takes. For some attachments, 1 or 2 sittings is all you'll need. Some other attachments might take a week, might take 2 weeks or even longer, who knows. It doesn't matter. If you need time, you can take time. You have all the time there is. You will feel a very, very strong sense of relief when you let go of the hatred you have towards these people. Then anytime you think of them, you kind of think of them with a mind that says, well, they made a mistake, they didn't know what they were doing. It's okay. That's how you let go of an attachment craving. That's how you let go of the pain of that past situation. This doesn't mean that the person who was violated is going to go up and hug the person who did that to them. They would avoid them, because they know there is a possibility of personal harm, but they don't hate them anymore. They don't think about it anymore. They have let it go. That's what the forgiveness is all about. It's about letting go. You are giving up old dissatisfaction and dislike. You are developing a mind that says, well, that's okay. You can be like that. That is not taking it personally. Chapter 10, Obstacles. The biggest part of the mindfulness of forgiveness meditation is learning how to let go of your personal opinions, ideas, concepts, stories. You might stay with a person for a long period of time because of your opinions and your attachment to this. Every time you're doing any walking or sitting meditation, keep forgiving them over and over again. Your mind might get bored with that and say, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Well, that's another kind of attachment, isn't it? So, what do you do with that? You have to get through it by forgiving the boredom for being there. That's okay. Your mind is tricky. It's going to try to distract you any way it can. It'll bring up any kind of feelings and thoughts and ideas to distract you, because it doesn't like the idea of giving up attachments. Your mind really feels comfortable holding on to attachments. We need to go easy on ourselves as we develop this practice. After all, how many years did it take us to build up our habits, Bhava? It takes patience to move in the opposite direction now and to change those unwholesome mind states into new wholesome tendencies. Be kind to yourself and take your time. The whole point of the meditation is learning how to change, learning how to let go of those old nonsense ideas and thoughts and develop new ideas and thoughts that make you happy and make other people around you happy too. That's the whole reason for the precepts. They outline an option for us to follow so we gain balance in our life. Let's take a quick look at the precepts. Do not kill any living beings on purpose. Don't take what is not freely given to you. No stealing. Don't engage in wrong sexual activity with another person's mate or a person too young living with the parents. In short, don't do anything that will cause mental or physical harm to any other human being. Don't engage in telling lies, using harsh language, gossip, or slander. Lastly, don't take recreational drugs or alcohol, because these will weaken mind and the tendency to break the other precepts is stronger. These precepts are like an ultimate operational manual for life. If you keep them well, then you get the most out of your life. They make you and others around you happy. The more you can continually follow them, the better your frame of mind will become. You will more easily forgive that other person. Your mind will become softer towards that person, and you will feel more relief. What happens is, after you practice this way for a while, then you go, ah, I do, I really do forgive you, and there's no energy behind it at all. It's just like, yeah, this happened, it's in the past, it's no big deal. This is what forgiveness is all about. Chapter 11, Daily Life. How can this practice affect your daily life? This is a good question. You're more open, you're more accepting, you're not judging, you're not condemning, you're not disliking, because as you see the tightness of mind coming up in you, and you go, oops, I forgive you for not understanding this one, and you smile. You let it go. One of the hardest things a guiding teacher has to do is to teach people that life is supposed to be fun, it's a game. Keep it light. If you play with your mind and your attachments, that means you're not being attached to them so much as you play with them. You're not taking them so seriously anymore. When you don't take them seriously, they're easier to let go of. That's what the Buddha was teaching us. He was teaching us how to have an uplifted mind all of the time, how to be able to be light with your thoughts, with your feelings, and your ideas, and your past actions. Yes, it's true. On some occasion, you made a mistake. Well, okay. Welcome to the human race. I don't know of anyone who hasn't made a mistake and felt guilty about it. Sure they do. And what is that guilt? Non-forgiveness. That's an example of your mind grabbing onto what's happening and saying, I really screwed up, and I need to punish myself for that. That's what your mind is saying. Now, do you see what you can do about this? Right. The more you become serious with your daily life, the more attachments you will have. The less equanimity, the less mental balance you will have in your life. There is no question about it. You're on these roller coasters, emotional roller coasters, up and down, up and down. When you start forgiving more, those high highs and low lows start to turn into little waves. You still have some, but you don't get caught for as long. You just stop and say, this just isn't important enough to get upset about. Chapter 12, Success. After you forgive that person, you stay with them, you stay with that person that's come up into your mind until you feel like, enough, I don't have to do this anymore. I really have forgiven you. At that point, with your mind's eye, you look them straight in the eye, and you stop verbalizing, and you hear them say back to you, I forgive you too. Wow, now this is different, isn't it? It's kind of remarkable. You have this feeling of being forgiven as well as you forgiving them. You've forgiven yourself for making mistakes, for not understanding. You've forgiven that other person for making mistakes, for not understanding, or causing pain. Whatever you want, using the statement that really makes it true for you. And now, you hear them say, I forgive you. There is a real sense of relief. Wow, what happens in your mind now is the joy comes up in your mind. You feel light. You feel really happy, happier than you ever felt before. You didn't realize you were carrying these big bundles of rocks on your shoulders, holding you down, did you? And now, you have put them down. When you forgive, the heaviness of those hard feelings and rocks disappear. You feel light. Oh my, this really is great stuff. It takes a lot of work, but it's worth it. It's not easy. Why isn't it easy? Because of the amount of attachment we have. When we begin, you keep doing the meditation, and when you get done with one person, you go back to yourself. You repeat, I forgive myself for making mistakes. I forgive myself for not understanding. You stay with yourself until somebody else comes up into your mind. You keep on doing that until your mind says, okay, I've done it. Everything is good. There's nobody else. Enough. At this time, you can switch back to your mindfulness of loving kindness meditation and make it your primary formal practice. Now you can understand why mindfulness of forgiveness meditation is definitely part of loving kindness. How can you ever practice loving kindness if you have hatred? You can't. This practice releases the hatred. Chapter 13, Not Easy. This practice has no simple, easy, fast fix here. You can't just buy the solution this time at the mall either. You have to patiently continue this practice all the time until you release the unwholesome mind states which are your old habitual tendencies of mind. Depending on how attached you are to the idea that a person wronged you, or the idea of how badly you screwed up, this leads you into, I can never forgive myself. Until you finally go through this process of forgiveness, you'll not be free of this burden. You will know when you have gone entirely through the mindfulness of forgiveness meditation, because then you'll be free. And you will see clearly this is how forgiveness really works. Are you done? You don't have to have anybody to tell you that this worked. You'll know. The daily continuous work of this practice is most important. When you are walking from one place to another, I don't care what you are doing. Any kind of distraction that comes up, forgive it. Smile. If a person comes up to you and they start talking, and you don't want to talk, forgive them. They don't understand. They don't understand what you are doing. It's okay that they don't understand. It's okay that they don't know where you are or what you are doing. They can judge you. They can condemn you. They can cause all kinds of distractions, and that's fine. They can do that. But as for you, you can forgive them for it. As you forgive them, you are letting go of the attachment to the way I think things are supposed to be. Not understanding can be a really big thing, because we don't understand so much. We have our own opinions and ideas of the way things are supposed to work. That can be a problem. We get caught up by assumption. That's it, isn't it? What happens when things don't match your idea of the way things are supposed to work? What then? You may find yourself fighting with reality, which is the truth, the Dharma of the present moment. You're not accepting the reality that's right there in front of you. You begin judging and condemning, and most often blaming somebody else for disturbing you. Well, I'm sorry, they're not disturbing your practice. They're part of the practice. There's no such thing as something else or someone else disturbing my practice. It's only me fighting with what is real, the reality, the Dharma of the present moment, not liking this or that, and next I'm blaming somebody else or something else for the cause of that. Chapter 14, forgive it. What about sounds disturbing us while we practice? Sometimes, in a retreat, if you are concentrating too hard, you can observe what can happen. You could get so upset if there is even one squeak of a door or someone is walking by too heavily near you or breathing too loudly. You might jump up thinking, oh, you disturbed my practice. Do you begin to see how ridiculous this actually is? What is happening here is that the present moment produced a noise. And there was noise, and then mind came up and said, I don't like this. That's not supposed to be there. I want to complain to somebody and make them stop so my mind can be peaceful. What is actually happening is concentration is out of balance with mindfulness. Concentration is too strong and mindfulness is too weak. Ha ha ha. How crazy is that? If you can't accept what's happening in the present moment with a balanced mind, there will be suffering. Okay, so, there's a noise. There's somebody talking, so it doesn't matter, just as long as you have mindfulness and equanimity in your mind. When balance is in your mind, if there is a noise, that's just fine. And you can do your forgiveness meditation. While I was in Asia on a 3-month retreat, there was a water well pump that was drilling for water right outside of the meditation hall. 3 months of an old clanky motor running from 8 o'clock in the morning until 6 o'clock at night. This can happen, you know. One continuous noise. It was really loud and really annoying, but it was just sound. That's all it was. I realized that it was not my sound. My dislike of that sound wasn't going to change that sound. My criticizing of the person that started the motor wasn't going to make that sound any different. Do you see where all the attachments are in this example? The exercise here is accepting the fact that sound is here, and it's okay for sound to be here. It has to be okay, because that's what's in the present moment. That's the truth Dharma. Accepting the present moment is accepting the Dharma just as it is. Whenever there is a disturbance, forgive the disturbance continually in your mind. Forgive, smile, forgive yourself for not understanding. That is how we work with forgiveness in daily life. I forgive myself for wanting things to be more perfect than they are. I forgive myself for making mistakes. I forgive myself for being angry and disliking this or that. Now we see that the forgiveness is not just one statement, it can be many. We take each of these statements into the practice and use them one by one. Chapter 15, No Mantras. While you're doing your sitting practice, once again, you just want to take one statement of forgiveness at a time. Stay with just one. Remember that this is not a mantra. You don't surface say this and think about something else either. It has to be sincere. I really to forgive myself for making mistakes or for not understanding or whatever. It's important to be sincere when you do this. The more you can continually forgive with your daily activities, with your sitting, with your walking meditation, whatever you happen to be doing, you need to realize that this is what meditation is really about. Meditation is not about gaining some superhuman state of mind. It's not just about bliss. It is more productive than that. It's about learning how you cause your own suffering and how to let go of that suffering. The deeper superhuman states of meditation will come up by themselves when we clear our minds and simply allow this to happen. You don't have to personally do anything. The more you clear yourself, the more you clear your mind of judgments, opinions, concepts, ideas, and the more you accept what's happening in the present moment, the more joyful life becomes. The easier life becomes. What's that you are saying now? Well, I have this habit of always analyzing and thinking, okay, let it go. But I have been doing this my whole life, so, hey, forgive yourself for not understanding. Forgive yourself for analyzing. There can be a strong attachment to wanting to analyze. That's the Western disease. I want to know how everything works. You don't learn how things work by thinking about them. You let go and relax to see how things work when you forgive and you let go and relax to develop space in your mind to observe how they work. The truth is that, in meditation, thinking mind, analyzing mind is incredibly slow. The aware mind is incredibly fast. It's extraordinary. You just can't get there with a lot of words in the way. You can't have opinions in the way. They will block you. They will stop you from seeing the way things truly are. Chapter 16, Blame Game. Your forgiveness meditation is more than just about old attachments like, well, when I was 5 years old, little Johnny. He beat me up, and I've hated him ever since then. See how this is about you and uncovering this attachment and how you hold onto it, and how you cause yourself pain because of that attachment. Most especially these days, people are really big on blaming everybody but themselves for the pain, and the question here should be, is that working with reality or not? It's easy to say, you caused me pain. I don't like you, but did someone else cause you pain? Or did I just say something and you had another kind of an opinion, and judged and condemned whatever I said, and then your aversion came up and the dislike of the whole situation, and now you're off to the races. And you're 1,000 miles away. You are causing yourself pain, and you're running into your thinking, but I'm only thinking and analyzing, ha 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 ha. Ha, you're attached. You think, this attachment won't hurt me so much if I keep distracted. I can keep my opinions and my ideas about the way things are supposed to be, and then I don't have to change, but you're fooling yourself. Change is the only way to free mind. Meditation is about positive change. Chapter 17, Be Happy. In summary, Buddhism is about realizing that you need to have a balanced and mindful mind that doesn't have high emotions in it, that doesn't have attachments in it, so that you can see things clearly and discover real happiness and contentment in daily life. Buddhism is about seeing the way things truly are, gaining knowledge by seeing for yourself how you are the cause of your own pain. It's about taking personal responsibility and doing the work needed to find this kind of mindfulness, balance, and understanding. Mindfulness of forgiveness meditation trains us to recognize clearly when suffering arises. First noble truth, to notice how we get personally involved with it and make it bigger, which causes more suffering in life. Second noble truth, and two, escape this dangerous trap by using the 6 R's and seeing how it disappears. Third noble truth, this meditation opens the way for clear understanding and relief. Fourth noble truth, the end result creates the space we need in our mind so that we begin to respond to life instead of reacting. Using the 6 R's, which fulfills the practice of right effort found in the early texts, using it with any meditation you are doing. This is one of the fastest ways for all people to see clearly what is really going on and to reach this kind of destination, where there can be happiness and peace. In Sutta number 21 of the Majjhima Nikaya, as translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, within the middle-length sayings and published by Wisdom Publications, it gives us some excellent advice that I would like to share with you now. It says, there are these 5 courses of speech that others may use when they address you. The speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or connected with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hatred. This is how I should train. My mind shall be unaffected, and I will utter no evil words. I shall abide compassionate for the welfare, with a mind of loving kindness, without inner hate. I shall abide pervading that person, whoever you talk With a mind imbued with loving kindness and forgiveness, and starting with him, I shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how I should train. Please use this forgiveness meditation often and train your mind to be happy.